Hi, and welcome back to the Creator Economy series. Today's episode is all about the evolution of creator monetization. Index partner Mark Goldberg speaks with the founders of Creative Juice, Printify, EQL, and 20VC. Let's dive right in.
Welcome, everyone, to the evolution of the creator monetization panel. My name is Mark Goldberg. I'm one of the partners at Index Ventures, and I'm thrilled to be joined by our other panelists today. Some great founders inside, outside the portfolio. Harry Stebbings, who I think is much more comfortable asking the questions. We'll see how he does answering the questions this time around. And thank you all for joining. And for our audience from very different time zones, we've got Australia to Europe to San Francisco. So thank you, everyone. We've been investing at Index around this theme of the creator economy for a number of years and have a strong belief that creators are the new small businesses. You all are very much at the forefront of that thesis. And so I thought before we kick into questions, I would actually just pass around and have everyone do a quick introduction, you know, on their own business. Harry, many of our audience members will know you from 20 Minute VC, but may be less familiar with your investing work. So I thought each of you could spend, you know, 30 to 60 seconds giving a quick intro. And why don't we start with you, Seema?
All right. Hi, everybody. Seema Gandhi. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Creative Juice. So a little about me. I spent 20 years of my career in financial services. So essentially helping people find better banking services who didn't necessarily get served really well. So I did that at the US government. I helped set up the CFPB, you know, regulation, really good stuff, right? And then went over to American Express. And most recently was at a fintech company called Plaid, where I joined early on as employee 15. And we almost sold to Visa for over $5 billion, which was amazing, but went on to raise even more money at higher valuation. So I'm a big fan of Plaid, obviously. And there we really built the financial infrastructure for fintech. And, you know, candidly, when I left Plaid, I thought that was an amazing run. I'm not sure what I want to do next. And I started getting exposed to the creator economy through conversations with my now co-founder, Ezra Cooperstein. And I just felt really moved by creators. These are people who are trying to pursue their passion and kind of saying a little bit of a F you to the STEM, like I have to do math and engineering to actually make a living, and are pursuing their passions and their creativity and building really amazing connections with people globally. But they're not really served by financial services. You walk into a bank and you say, hi, I'm a YouTuber. I make my living doing YouTube. And they're going to say, where's your W-2? I'm sorry, I don't understand that. Like, and candidly, I was one of those people. I said, yeah, influencers, they take pictures with ice cream cones and I don't know. But as I started digging in, I really started to appreciate the potential here. And like you, Mark, I think creators are the next generation of small businesses. Like in 10 years, every single business is going to have a creator component and vice versa. Creators are also going to own the idea of being a business more. And so we're really excited at Creative Juice to help creators get access to capital and the different financial and business tools that they need to grow.
Thanks, Seema. Andrew, how about you go next?
Sure thing. So Andrew Lipp, co-founder and CEO of Equal, based out of Melbourne, Australia. I was a 9-year Googler up until early this year, and whilst there, completely institutionalized in the Google world. But I'm also an old and miserable sneaker fan, too old to kind of line up at stores. I've got two little kids, so I'm not getting up in the middle of the night to jump online and try to see the latest shoes that are dropping, but was experiencing this scenario where hype was driving chaos online and infrastructure wasn't holding up to the chaos and frenzies of these drops. I had an experience where I jumped on, thought I'd won a pair of sneakers only to get into store and find out that there was no transaction credited to me and they couldn't even return the funds. So realized maybe sneakers is a proxy for this world of hype commerce out there where there's high demand, frenzies ensue, sites go down, bots and scammers clear out stock, and real fans don't get their hands on the products they love. So as a true marketing person, which was my background, I put together a very pretty deck. And myself, along with a couple of co-founders at Google, ended up sending a cold email into Nike out of EMEA. We were able to actually pitch the idea, and a few weeks later, we got a call to kick that platform off. They wanted to use us for a hype launch out of Paris for a designer doing a collaboration with the Jordan sneaker. In true fashion, you quickly say you have the product and then you go and work out how to build it. So we did that. And fast forward now, we've built a hype commerce platform, which is... It supplies infrastructure to retailers. We work with Nike, Foot Locker, Crocs, a heap of global brands out there to help them manage their hype drops. We provide the infrastructure. We do a lot of the scammer detection to ensure that, you know, bot scammers and resellers aren't the folks getting their hands on the products. And we do all of their outsourced checkout. But ultimately, our aim is to build the world's fairest hype commerce platform and to get products into the hands of real fans. And I think at first principles, we're all about managing hype demand and knowing who your real true fan is. And long tail of our world is absolutely helping out creators out there with quick infrastructure to get products into the hands of real fans and to really monetize those fans and know who they really are.
Thank you, Andrew. Harry, you want to take us next?
Well, I mean, Andrew, I'm your real true fan, but that's because I invested in you and I like dollars. My life has changed when I watched The Social Network. I was 13 years old and I saw Peter Thiel invest in Facebook with Clarion Capital. And I was like, wow, you can make money from investing in amazing technology companies. This is awesome. And then when I was 18, I basically realized that, you know, capital was coming incredibly commoditized and that personal brands were more important than ever. So I started a podcast from my bedroom. I was, as I said, 18. I had $50. I spent $40 on the microphone, $10 on the domain name. And then I cold emailed VCs asking them to hop on as Skype at the time. Skype cool with me. Honestly, I never meant to make any money from it. I just wanted a job in venture. And then my mother came down the stairs one day and said, she had multiple sclerosis and has multiple sclerosis. She said, medication is going to be supremely expensive and I'm going to get much worse because we can't afford it. And I said, don't you worry, Jules. I got this covered. I've got it, you know, 500K, whatever. Yeah, easy. She's like, darling, you still eat my lasagna and my garlic bread and you've never made a dollar in your life. And so I went upstairs and a month later we paid for 500K and made it happen. And so that was kind of how I turned it into a business, which is more out of kind of funny, but not forced, but kind of needing to. We've scaled now into a multi-million pound media business on that side. And there's a whole team in the media company there. And then I raised an $8 million fund. Bluntly went much better than I could have hoped for. We got 9 unicorns in that first fund. And then I raised a much larger $140 million fund between growth and early stage. And so, yeah, pretty much live the dream. I get to interview amazingly cool people and invest at the same time. It's great. There's no wonder I'm smiling, but very, very happy. And that's how I manage my life.
There's a lot of interesting things you just said, but the fact that you were 13 when you were watching The Social Network certainly makes me feel old in this panel. A nice little snapshot for me.
It explains why I had so few friends in high school, but yeah, thank you.
James, you want to take us home?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me. So about Printify, I'm the CEO and founder of Printify. Printify empowers creators with on-demand production. So any kind of t-shirts, mugs, hats, hoodies, dresses, even skateboards or pillows or pretty much any kind of merchandise you can imagine with custom design. We have the tool set for creators to easily set up those products, create virtual inventory on your, let it be Shopify store or any other e-commerce solution. And those products are produced only when your customer buys from them, typically within 24 to 48 hours, and dropship directly to the end consumer. So when the end consumer receives the package, it seems like it came directly from the creator because it would have the branding on the package of the creator. Short story on Printify, and you're happy to support thousands and thousands of creators on their entrepreneurial journeys.
James and everyone else, thank you. All right, let's dive into things. Seema, I'm going to start with you. You talked about in the intro how you felt like the YouTuber who walks into a bank might not be as well understood as they should. Maybe you can comment for the audience here on what you think, just knowing the traditional financial system so well, are the big gaps that do a disservice to this new creator class that's emerging?
Look, I think for any economic segment or any industry to grow, you need access to capital. That's just a reality. Any business that wants to reach its full potential needs someone that's going to invest in them. And the creator economy, if you really take a step back, it's staggering how quickly it's grown without access to this type of capital. A lot of the creators she spoke to, it's organic growth, it's friends and family, it's parents that help them out. I mean, Harry, I don't know your story, and I'd be curious, maybe in a separate moment to talk about how you went in 1 month, right, to where you did, but I think there's so many folks out there that have that potential in that story, but don't have access to the type of resources that a small business would have. And coming from traditional financial services and from the government, there is a strong element of just steer the course because they're such big enterprises. And a lot of traditional underwriting is really built around the W-2. Like, what's your paycheck look like every 2 weeks and who's your employer? And to say that you're a YouTuber or that, you know, you post on Instagram and you have brand dollars, I think, you know, traditional financial services would look at that and say, well, that's not predictable. That's not real revenue. I can't take a bet on you. But when you take a step back and you say, well, actually, that's just one piece of revenue in this larger business. And like, let's understand what it looks like to build out your different revenue streams and the path that you're going in. Now you're having a very different conversation with a person who's also a business versus just kind of seeing someone who looks like a hobbyist. And so, you know, I think over the last 5 years, the creative economy has matured a lot. I mean, we're still in very, very early days. It feels like fintech did to me 10 years ago. Like, we're still having small little conferences and dinking little hotels. It's not Money 2020 in Las Vegas. And, you know, what I think that means is that we're now beginning to talk about creators who have consistent enough income and there's enough data analytics that we can actually predict what that looks like. But I don't think we could have had that conversation 5 years ago. And so as this continues to mature, where I think, you know, we can step in is say, we understand you as a creator and your potential as a business. We can model what that looks like because we've got enough of that historical data points. And the reality is it can get pretty consistent and we want to take bets against that. We want to invest and give access to capital to creators so that they can jumpstart their growth. And so there's a lot that we're doing in that vein over at Creative Juice, but more broadly, I think, you know, that's where the financial services system breaks down for creators.
I mean, Hera, you got teed up by Seema here, but I'd be very curious. I mean, when you were starting, and again, this is a few years ago, did you feel any of those pain points in the British banking system? Could you get credit? Where'd you put that first $500,000? I'm curious what your experience was.
Well, I mean, mine sounds a little trite. We just made a lot of cash pretty quickly. And so, no, I didn't really. And I was 18. And so it was like, you know, 99% profit margin sitting in a bedroom. And I mean, the way we did it, honestly, was I analyzed the five most funded VC segments, which at the time was like sales tools, CRM solutions. And then they also had to be most competitive. And then I cold emailed their CEOs of those companies. And I said, hey, you know, I love your solution, but your biggest competitor wants to sponsor the show, why don't we make it work instead? And they're like, yes, absolutely. 25K, 50K, fine, great. I've just raised 100 million. And you're like, oof, this is easy, baby. And you got 10 at 50 and made them pay up front because I'd charge 75 if they wanted to pay in installments. And so I'd give you a nice 25K discount. I paid up front. And so they paid up front, gave them 7-day net terms. And yeah, it was a lot of hustle, but it worked.
Okay. My lesson is that sort of hustle can overcome the deficiencies in the traditional financial institutions. But for those of the audience out there that haven't experienced that quick success, I think that the pain points resonate with me, Seema. Hey, James, let's go over to you. You know, one of the things we've seen is this massive shift from advertising to commerce in the way that creators monetize. I mean, again, you guys are at the forefront of that. You're helping people buy merch and products and exclusive access. How are you working with the long tail of creators to open up that commerce avenue to folks that otherwise would have had a really hard time getting there?
Yeah, I think there is a big difference of being a big creator like Mr. Beast, who has a huge team working for him and helping him and doing all the branding and merchandising and finance things and everything else that he needs, versus the creators that are just starting out that do not have the access to those resources. And so we are really trying and providing the tools for those small creators who want to build their own brand and monetize their audience rather than just renting out their and the ad space, rather actually selling directly to them. And so we provide the tools to make it very easy. So the e-commerce functionality and most importantly, we focus on the fulfillment experience. So that it would, any creator who wants to monetize their audience, they can find the products they want to sell on Printify. And pretty much they just set it up and they can forget about fulfillment. All of that is handled by Printify. And so we are making it really, really easy for anyone who just is on his own and just starting out to start monetizing their audience using e-commerce, which we strongly believe and know is much better than just doing the ads and provides much better revenue.
Is there a sweet spot for your customer base? I mean, obviously, not everyone can have an audience like Mr. Beast or Gwyneth Paltrow with the Goop. Is there a floor that you should get to before thinking about e-commerce as a monetization path? Or do you see everything from the smallest to...
Absolutely not. We have big amount of signups that try out Printify are just starting out and they have not done e-commerce before. And so this is their first venture into e-commerce. And we see many of them succeeding to an amazing success. And we have creators that are doing millions of dollars in e-commerce sales a year. So we have seen amazing success stories from really creators that didn't have any e-commerce background before and experience to becoming successful really quickly. The key, I think, is having a really engaged audience, knowing what your audience likes and creating merchandise catered specifically, uniquely to your audience.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to keep it going. Andrew, you guys are at the frontier of this hype, scarcity, drops, and overall, you talked about this in your introduction, but just creating a fairer playing field for everyone involved here. Can you talk about how creators are using Equal and what you've observed in that capacity?
So it's an interesting one. We see right now we're kind of new into the market, right? So we're largely working with global brands, but those global brands are partnering with creators out there and doing a whole host of very funky collaborations, right? We work with Crocs, who releases gibbets that are little things you can attach to your Crocs, and they partner with creators, across a whole host of countries and areas. But I think the broader thing we're looking at is our hype infrastructure is very much like a splash page. Like, it's infrastructure that can give a creator the power just to pretty much push a page live. But the way we think about drops is all about driving hype in the experience, so maximizing the moment. So there's timers and there's this vibe of if you're not going to get in now, you're going to miss out quickly. We also do a whole host of signaling around who the people that are entering these draws and showing their interest really are. So we look at signals around, have they purchased previously? Have they engaged in content with you? Have they shown that they're a super fan? Because I think how we're thinking about it is that a creator or a big brand out there, it's all good and well, you get followers and likes, but what's the intent to purchase? Is there a segment of your audience that you really need to be focusing on? Because, you can transact the most out of them. So, we really think about when we put our creators hat on, we think about how can creators out there not only create the hype, how can they get to market quickly and monetize that hype, but also how do they know which user is going to return the most value to them?
Well, I'm still waiting for the 20-minute VC drop of the latest. Are you going to maybe a Croc sponsorship? I think would be a very appropriate merchandise for you. I don't know if you've given any thought, Harry.
No, I quite want to do like an NFT, and I'm just contemplating what my NFT should be, whether it's like, the original like bedroom where it was recorded, or like a microphone, or like the first album artwork. This could be it. Or like I was quite young when I started, so like, a picture of me starting, that would be an interesting one.
Harry, I don't think our infrastructure can manage your hype, to be honest.
Oh, stop it. You are too kind. Too kind. He told me this before I wrote the check, and I was like, yes, done.
All right, so the NFT is going to be the first. Thank you for, by the way, speeding through to the last question I had prepared here. No, we're going to go back to you, Harry. So you have a very unique perspective. You are both a creator in and of your own right, which we've discussed. You're an investor in a lot of very prominent creators. But I wanted to ask you something more personal, which is how have you balanced the creative nature of the content you create and produce with the business mentality of creating what is now, as you mentioned in the intro, a multi-million dollar company just on the media side of your enterprise. So how do you think about the duality between the creative and entrepreneurship side of your brand?
Fundamentally, it's exactly the same. It's the most interesting comparison between an interviewer and a venture capitalist, which is like, at the beginning of an interview, you have 3 minutes to build trust, to build safety, to make you, Mark, feel like you can tell me anything and this is a safe space free from judgment. That is how you have to do it as an interviewer that will get the best content. they will unlock a huge amount more when they feel safe. And it's exactly the same when you meet a founder. You have to make them feel completely free to share that their head of sales has just left. They're going to miss their numbers. But actually, X is exciting and Y is exciting. But you have to provide that environment in the first 3 minutes. And so I find things like that mean there's just so much alignment in what I do. And you know, the conversations that I have help me inform my investment decision making. They help me build stronger rounds. And so for me, whenever anyone was like, oh, how do you do both? They're actually beautifully aligned. And, you know, I always say that, you know, we're a media company that invests and we use the media company to invest better. And so for me, they're very aligned. The media company takes a lot of time, but it fundamentally powers, you know, the investing and hopefully gives us a different edge to make us better. It does mean you just work harder and I have less free time, but I love it. It's the most incredible thing. It's also like being a VC because you interview someone, Mark. And when they say something amazing, you get the credit for it as the interviewer. It's an absolute joke. It's like being a VC. I invest in Andrew. He does all the work. And then I get on the Forbes Blinders list, hopefully. Like, this is brilliant. Like, this is the ultimate form of leverage. Another brilliant life. So,
Harry, you're really giving me a view under the hood here. I feel like you got me with all your tricks. And now I'm seeing what those tricks really were.
Charm and the British accent, my friend. It always works. So I don't know if that answers your question, but for me, they're just beautifully aligned and one powers the other and the other, they're very kind of powerful in unison.
Great. So conflict between right brain, left brain, not an issue. It's synergistic and it sounds like that's working for you.
Yeah, it's totally synergistic. It's also like everyone forgets in venture, the most important thing is likability. You can have incredible IQ and a great thesis and you can pick the right company. But if I can't sit across the table from, you know, Seema or Andrew, you know, or James and fundamentally make them compelled to work with me over someone else, well, it doesn't matter that I have the right thesis or I could pick the company because I'm not going to win. So like, again, it's like likability in an interview. You have to have that rapport. And so again, so many things, but I think they're actually much closer than people think.
Harry, I think you're a bit of a unicorn because of, like you seem to just have fallen into something that's very natural to you. But, you know, we've spoken to hundreds of creators at this point now. And it's interesting because Harry, I think there are some that are like you where it's totally synergistic and it makes sense and feels native. But I think a lot of creators struggle to actually call themselves a business because it feels anathema to being creative. It's like, it's almost like the money and the business part is dirty and it like dirties the creative process. And so then that's what the manager or the team takes care of, like the money side, but like the creator focuses on the creator side. And, you know, part of our hope and we're starting to invest in content and talking about that and making it feel more accessible is because I think if you can bridge them the way that Harry has done, there's just so much potential there. And I really hope folks can really own both sides of that.
I think it's much easier. I heard this term the other day, if you're a finfluencer, which is obviously a fintech influencer, because you know, if you build a great revenue generating, strong business, it just powers your community even more. And they just, it's a good thing. Whereas I think if you're, you know, more in the lifestyle creation business or the fashion creation business, more you worry about transactionalizing your content, you know, commoditizing your audience. And so I totally understand that if you're not in kind of fintech influencing, then, which is a terrible term, but do you know what I mean? It's tougher. And so I do totally understand that kind of contrast and conflict.
All right. Well, we only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to actually put a few questions to the group and anyone who wants to can just jump in. All right. First question. You all have very unique perspectives into the creator economy. Seema, you just talked about, you know, having worked with hundreds and hundreds of creators at this point. What do you think some of the biggest pain points that exist for creators are to run their business, period, at this point in the evolution of this segment?
The biggest pain, I'm biased because our business is built on knowing the user. But I think, you know, the creator and creator economy, you know, it started at the very basics of your Facebooks and your YouTubes of views and likes, which kind of the quality of that metric doesn't really show you the truest of fans. And I think really, you know, knowing how to monetize the right segment in your audience is really important, right? And it goes to what Harry said there, in that, you know, you can have a product, you can have a brand, you can associate to beauty or fashion or whatever, and you can have a big audience, but if you can't kind of extract some value from that audience, then, you know, you're going to be spinning your wheels a lot. So being able to have the insight into your audience and knowing really how to maximize the demand from them, for me, is going to be the way that creators really kind of commercialize their world and make it a full-time gig.
So for me, I think it's kind of along the lines of what we were talking about bridging that creator mindset and that business mindset. And that business mindset is, yeah, understanding your analytics, what exactly to do there, how to hustle, right? Like the way, you know, Harry was talking about earlier. And then, you know, just more tactically, I think it's just access to capital and being able to invest in the things that you want to be able to really reach your full potential as a business.
I think there's a big problem also that a lot of people don't address, which actually is you scale into larger and larger customers on the creator side and you work with bigger and bigger brands, your payment flows are actually very inconsistent. The net payment terms are actually often a lot longer. And for creators who, you know, need money to create content, need money to live, it is fundamentally challenging when you have 120-day net payment terms or 90-day net payment terms, and you've got to pay editors, pay producers. And so the payment upfront for you is large, and then it's quite heavily put downstream. And so I think there's a real opportunity, and I'm sure someone's probably doing it, but in the pipe, you know, or revenue for creators, if someone's doing it, then, you know, let me know. But I think that's a very big problem that I see a lot of influencers suffering with. And needs to be plugged.
Well, clearly we should move on. Seema didn't want to address any of what you just said, Harry, I think.
Harry, we can talk after. We can help you with that.
Right.
That's 100%. When I talk about access to capital, it's not only a traditional loan, but like going back to what we were talking about, creators don't have W-2s. You don't have your income every 2 weeks. It's lumpy. So it's not like there's not enough money. It's just lumpy. And so we want to help creators even that out. And that's something we can chat about.
Yeah, love to.
Harry, you talked about, you know, the payments from brands. And I think I read an interesting stat as I was actually walking into this room to do the interview or the panel here, that brand revenue is still the lion's share of the way that creators are monetizing today. If you all were to predict 5 years from now, you know, the sort of monetization paths that we will see creators take in order to, you know, to really become sustainable businesses, I'm curious what people think that pie chart will look like between, you know, James with some of the merchandise and e-commerce products, with brands, with ad revenue, with all sorts of new monetization modes that will continue to feel increasingly authentic, hopefully, and not just like random placements. Roll the clock forward for us. Who wants to take a bold prediction about the ways creators will monetize in the coming years?
I'm glad to share that I'm very bullish that the share of direct commerce, so the creators selling directly to their fans, will grow significantly. And just the logic of, instead of trying to build somebody else's brand that is already huge, why not building your own brand? And there are so many creators that have had big audiences and build their own sneaker brands, or pretty much you can look for both in food and in merchandise, etc. So there are many opportunities to build their own brands, and it's just a logical step that why not building your own brand?
I'm going to be selling some 20 VC t-shirts after this with Printify, James. I'm going to send you. I mean, let me just jump in. But you've got, you know, ad revenue, subscription revenue. You've got merchandise. I think you've got new ancillary channels like NFTs, collectibles. You know, for me, mine's a bit of a skewed business as well, because like, I would rather make less money and have a bigger audience, because for me, it drives the investment fund. And so mine's not like a pure play, like revenue optimization game. But I think those will continue to be your lion's share, bluntly. I'd love to see more. I think the more mechanisms we can have for creators, bluntly, making more and more revenue is great. But I think those will be the lion's share between those four.
I agree too. I think, you know, James's point is right. Like, it's the technology gets cheaper and better for creators to be able to put out their, you know, their 20 VC t-shirts and shoes and fitness gear and like all of that. I think people are going to want to buy from like this new cottage industry of creators that they relate to, versus going to like Gap or Abercrombie and Fitch and buying generic brands that may or may not relate to them. So I'm really excited for just this idea of like bespoke, like connecting with different types of goods and products, from even furniture, rugs, like all of it. I think merchandising will be a huge piece, but I do think that the brand revenue, which today I think about is about 80%, will continue to grow massively.
James, Harry, Andrew, Seema, thank you so much for being a part of our summit here. It was great to get all of your perspectives. I'm sure the audience had a good time with this one, and hope everyone has a great rest of your day.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard here, please subscribe to Index Audio so you can stay up to date on future episodes. Bye for now.